Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to southern Turkey near the Syrian border to speak with Rafif Jujati, the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the nonviolent umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. We will discuss the opposition's decision to attend the Geneva II talks next Wednesday in Switzerland and who among the fractured opposition recently at war with each other will attend, and what the expectations are for a peace conference, given Assad's bottom line that he will not step down and the opposition's bottom line that Assad must first step down. Then we'll look into the latest scandal engulfing New Jersey Governor Christie following allegations by the mayor of Hoboken that she was pressured to approve a development project the governor was behind in order to receive disaster relief money from Hurricane Sandy that inundated 80% of Hoboken. John Weingart, the Associate Director of the Eagleton Institute for Politics at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss this latest in a series of scandals following the bridge closure that are dogging Christie, who only gave Hoboken $142,000 of the $100 million in FEMA money the mayor asked for. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of President Obama's recent proposal to reform the NSA's eavesdropping activities, which have been met with tepid approval from the tech giants who are concerned they will lose between $30 and $100 billion as a result of the NSA's ubiquitous spying on internet communications, and an underwhelming response from civil libertarians who feel Obama's proposal barely begins to address the problem. William Arkin, the co-author of the Washington Post landmark series Top Secret America and the author of the new book American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution, joins us. Joining us now is Rafif Jujati, who is the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committee. That's the nonviolent umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. She's a Syrian-American activist and works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria. And Rafif joins us from southern Turkey near the Syrian border. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rafif Jujati.
Thank you very much.
And at this point, it looks like the Geneva II conference beginning on the 22nd of January in Montreux in Switzerland looks as though it's going ahead and some of the opposition have agreed to join. So at this point, let's begin with that. Who among the opposition have agreed to join in these talks?
I don't have the specific names yet. But what I know is that the majority voted to join the talks, and so they will be sending a delegation. I've also heard that some of the armed opposition representatives will be sending representatives as well, so it looks like the delegation that's going will be more representative of Syrians than not.
But some of the opposition have said that, and for example, ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, they have said that anybody who goes to the Geneva II talks are traitors. So clearly they're not involved.
Well, we in the opposition, both formal and informal, as part of the revolution, do not consider ISIS to be representative of the Syrian people. In fact, we consider ISIS to be traitors of the Syrian people. We know that many of the ISIS combatants in Syria are not Syrian. They are neither Iraqi nor Syrian. They come from all other parts of the world, and they think they are fighting a jihad. We, the Syrian people, are fighting a brutal dictatorship. There's a fundamental difference.
Well, in terms of the dictatorship, Syria's Bashar al-Assad has said that he has no intention of quitting and that his leaving office is not even up for debate. So that seems to be the preconditions that the Syrian regime has placed on going to Geneva. So you have an impasse here. Clearly, as far as I understand from your point of view, Rafif Jujati, the opposition wants Assad out, and Assad's basically, his beginning position is that my removal is not negotiable. Is that right?
I think that's pretty accurate, but what's important to remember is that because a military solution is not an option. We have to look to a political solution, and that needs to start in Montreux on the 22nd. And we need to get parties to the table, and we need to begin the process of discussing a transition in Syria. Bashar al-Assad is refusing to budge. Of course, he's been refusing to budge for the past 3 years, and he has deliberately and willfully ignored the voice of the people, so much so that now we have upwards of 150,000 people dead and millions of people internally displaced and in refugee camps abroad. Notwithstanding, there is not going to be a military solution anytime soon, and so we resort to a political process. I think it's going to be long. I think it's going to be very difficult. But one of the first goals of this political process is to stop the bloodshed.
And this political process has been started by the U.S. and Russia and the U.N., and the first communique was back in 2012, and now Geneva II is about to take place. Excluded, though, in terms of foreign powers, is Iran, and the U.S., Russia, and Syria want Iran included, but the United States and the West is basically saying Iran should not be at Geneva unless they agree to Geneva I, the original accords. Is that the situation?
I think that's pretty much the situation. It's important to keep in mind that the Geneva I communique has specific language in it around a transition of power and Assad stepping down. So if the regime's negotiating position a couple of days ahead of the peace talks is to not negotiate, then let that be the case. Let them state that openly. Let them show up in Geneva and say they are not going to accept the very basis of Geneva II. Then we can move from there.
Well, I'm looking at some of the communiques from Geneva I, and what jumps out here is that free and fair multi-party elections for the new institutions and offices will have to be established, and full representation of women in all aspects of the transition has to be established. So let's start with that. Is it possible? I mean, Assad has, and the Assad family, who have ruled Syria for the last four decades, have used these phony elections where sometimes they get more than 100% of the vote. In this case, the communique is calling for real elections and for full representation of women.
Absolutely. So we are not expecting very much from the Assad regime if it decides to hold elections in March, since Bashar al-Assad plans to run unopposed in a fake election. But you bring up a very, very important point, and that is about women's representation. As you may know, a group of Syrian women recently convened a conference in Geneva ahead of the Geneva II talks, and we presented to the international community a paper that basically outlines a list of demands by Syrian women for adequate representation in the opposition and during any negotiations and in any committees that are set up to reform electoral law or design a new constitution. And so I think we are gathering some momentum for full representation. And, of course, Ban Ki-moon's invitation to the Geneva II conference also included very specific language about the representation of women. So these are positive steps. Now, if we can get to Geneva II and begin the process, then we can also build on the momentum of the Women's Conference in Geneva and ensuring that any new government is fully representative of the Syrian people.
So you, I take it, will be going to Geneva at the moment. You're there where most of the opposition is, inside southern Turkey, near the Syrian border. But in terms of events on the ground, Rafiq Shishadi, there's been an enormous amount of fratricide lately in around Aleppo in particular, in the occupied areas, the opposition-occupied areas. between the Free Syrian Army and even al-Nusra has joined them against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So can you give us an update on this fratricide, which of course does not appear to indicate a lot of cohesion, shall we say, amongst the rebels?
Well, what we're seeing is a little bit more coordination between the FSA and Jabhat al-Nusra, and we're seeing that the Syrian people are calling for ISIS to leave. There are ongoing skirmishes. We also know that the regime dropped some 15 barrel bombs on Aleppo yesterday, and so the regime is also contributing what it can to the ongoing bloodshed. What we're seeing is armed groups pitting each other, they're pitting themselves against one another, and we're seeing the regime egg them on a couple of days ahead of a supposed peace conference to which they will be a party. I can't speak to the minute-by-minute events on the ground, but they are changing rapidly. All I do know for a fact is that dozens and dozens of civilians are being killed every hour.
Well, my understanding is that the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant have treated the Syrian civilians in the occupied area with unbelievable brutality. They've executed young children for supposed infractions against Sharia law and all of the impositions that they want to bring. But there's also been reports that for example, there was a report from the BBC recently where the Syrian Air Force flew over to drop these barrel bombs, and the ISIS fighters mounting anti-aircraft guns refused to shoot at it.
Absolutely. We are seeing mounting evidence of collusion between the Assad regime and ISIS, and it makes perfect sense. Assad has always maintained that he is a secularist, that the alternative to his form of tyranny is the Islamists, the jihadists, like ISIS. And what we're seeing is that those two groups are feeding each other's narrative. There have been multiple instances where the Assad regime has not fired on ISIS positions, although they were firing on the Free Syrian Army barely a kilometer away. We're seeing a lot of collusion in terms of arms trading and in terms of exchanges of money. Now, what we have seen with ISIS is that they have resorted to the same tactics as the Assad regime. So the kidnapping, execution, torture of civilians is not new to the Syrian people because we've been living with this for five decades. In the past 3 years, almost 3 years, we have seen this on a daily basis from the regime. And so what is important to note is now that the civilian population of Syria is caught in the crossfire between two armed forces who are bent on imposing their own dictatorship. For us, it's the same thing. It's a dictatorship. We're not going to trade one for another.
Well, I guess the difference is that Assad tends to kill people who oppose him, whether they're secular or religious, and the ISIS people kill people because they're secular.
Well, I think the ISIS people kill people who oppose them, whether it's on a religious basis or a secular basis or political basis. I think the ISIS folks are no better than the regime.
So tell me then about, in terms of the delegation that's going to Geneva, the National Coalition, but the Syrian National Council threatened to pull out of the coalition if the umbrella group's Ahmed Jabra went to the talks. And also, apparently, Syria's Kurds, who represent about 10% of the population, they want to send their own representative as part of the National Coalition delegation. So where does that stand in terms of particularly of Ahmed Jabra?
The last I heard was that the Syrian National Council had selected representatives to participate in the Geneva talks. I believe the delegation that is going to Geneva is being looked at very critically, even as we are speaking, and I think by tomorrow morning they will have finalized the list of names. And so I can only call on them and support them in their efforts to make sure the delegation truly is representative of Syria's people, and heeds their call and makes the number one priority of these talks to stop the killing.
So what representation do you have as the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the nonviolent umbrella group of the Syrian opposition? Is this mostly about the fighters going to the table, or are the nonviolent opposition represented as well?
So the local coordination committees has a voting seat in the opposition coalition. I don't know that we will have a representative in Geneva, but it's possible that we will. My hope is that the opposition coalition and the regime envoys and the United Nations and the Friends of Syria stress the importance of including civil society in these talks, stress the importance of including women and minorities in these talks, because to truly begin a political process, you have to have full representation. If it's simply going to be a negotiation between armed parties, I don't know that they will take into account the civilian casualties.
So not only have there been, as you mentioned, 150,000 civilian casualties, there's also over 200,000 people in prison, many of whom will not come out and many of whom have not come out over this long war. I also recently had somebody who escaped from Syria who was telling me that her colleagues who were rounded up by the regime early in the democratic protests that were brutally squashed, that they were taken to prison, and on the way out, Assad's prison doctors injected them with AIDS and with hepatitis. So the full scope of the casualties is not known, but lately we've heard a lot of stories about starvation in various pockets of territory in Syria, and particularly in the Palestinian camps. So what is happening there? Apparently there's been a lift in the siege and some supplies are getting in. But what is the strategy there on the part of Assad? Is he trying to not just kill the opposition but also starve them?
Yes, those he cannot kill, he's going to starve to death. He's been doing this pretty systematically. We are seeing some 30 to 50 cases of starvation every day in the Yarmouk Palestinian camp in Damascus. There are areas surrounding the capital city of Damascus that have been under siege for a year. The Assad regime extracted promises from the civilian communities living there to raise the Assad flag in exchange for food. So here is yet another mechanism of torture. And the irony is that when they complied with that, because they are starving to death, they were fired upon, and many of the food supplies were denied. So it's a consistent stick-and-carrot approach, if you will, except the carrot is not forthcoming. We have reports of people resorting to eating leaves off trees, boiling twigs for food. We have seen people resorting to eat common household pets like cats and dogs. This is because the regime has blockaded the areas and will not allow humanitarian deliveries in the areas.
Well, Refi Shojati, I thank you very much for joining us here, and I look forward to catching up with you, particularly if you're able to go to Geneva too and give us a report on it. And again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Refi Shojati, who's the English language spokesperson for the Syrian Local Coordination Committees, the nonviolent umbrella group of the Syrian opposition. She's a Syrian-American activist who works to empower other activists to take action and inform the public about events in Syria, and she joined us from southern Turkey near the Syrian border. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the latest scandals dogging New Jersey's Governor Christie.